Welcome back to the Renaissance Foundation podcast, a podcast about inspiration made by the young people at our youth charity. We work to transform the lives of young carers and hospital patients in London by inspiring them to achieve their full potential. I'm Corey, a member of staff at Renaissance Foundation, and I intro and edit the podcast. Thank you to Jao, RF Young Leader, for letting us use your song on our podcast. I'm loving the new songs you've been making, by the way, so keep sending them over to us, Jao. I really enjoyed the fact that we got to share our last episode with Priya Aluwalia, with all of you lovely people at home. It was such a nice insight into the industry, and I feel that we were really lucky that we got to ask questions and get that expert level advice. I've even seen posters on the street for the new Aluwalia collection. So yeah, honestly, like a really unique opportunity to speak to the person behind that. But this week, we have another incredibly inspirational talk with a talented entrepreneur. We are super lucky that we got to speak with jewelry designer and creative director, Tessa Packard. She launched her own brand, Tessa Packard London, in 2013, and she's created many collections. Some can be seen on celebrities at awards and premieres, and she regularly features in luxury fashion and lifestyle magazines like Condé Nast Traveler, Lux Magazine, and Vanity Fair. Thank you so much for talking to us, Tessa. This was such a fun chat and you gave us really important information. Even the fact you showed us your scrapbook and past collections and talked us through like your creative process, that was amazing. We've never seen anything like that before and it was just really fun. Like, you really inspired us. Thank you, Tessa. Thanks to all the young people that took part. I learned a lot from the questions you asked. They were brilliant and it felt really refreshing to be able to learn about ethical business practices. That's really important to all of us. And I felt it was so lucky that we got to learn about that from Tessa. Keep up those amazing questions, RF Young Leaders. You are all superstars. We hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it. If you want to find out more about Renaissance Foundation, how we support young carers and hospital patients, and how you can donate, please go to renaissance-foundation.com. If you like this episode, please subscribe and share. I'm going to hand over to our host, Nisha.
So thank you everyone for joining us. Let's start with the introductions, our favorite bit. So same as always, name, school year, but this time we're going to ask, if you were an animal, what would you be? And then don't forget to nominate the next person to introduce themselves as well. So I'm happy to start. Hi, everyone. I'm Nisha. I don't go to school anymore. If I would be an animal, I think I'd choose a jellyfish because I like the way that they move in the water. I think they're pretty nice. I would like to pick Favour to go next.
Yeah, I knew I was going to get picked. My name is Favour. I'm attending Canterbury Christchurch University. If I were an animal, it would probably be an eagle because I can fly. And I would be able to... I'll change it. It would probably be a parrot because just repeating what everyone says and just annoy everyone just for the fun of it. And I can also fly.
Good choice.
So I would like to nominate, is it Georgie?
And my name's Georgie. I'm in year 8 and I would be a turtle.
Thank you, Georgie. Would you like to nominate the next person?
Thanks, Georgie. That's a good choice, the turtle. I think they're very chilled out, aren't they? So I'm Sat. I'm past school. And my favourite animal is actually polar bears. I really like polar bears just because they just look really chilled out and they just walk around the ice and the snow and stuff. So I'd go for that. I'm going to introduce Grace.
Hi, everyone. I'm Grace. I'm also quite a bit past school. And just because we've been talking about them a lot today and I'm super desperate to have one day, my favourite animal is a dog. And he's underneath me. I'm going to nominate Chuck to go next.
Hi, my name is Chuck. I'm in secondary school and if I had to choose an animal to be, then I'd probably pick a cheetah because they can run very fast and they could get from one place to another, like to school and back home.
Good choice, Chuck. Who would you like to pick next?
I'll nominate Rafay.
So Rafay says, "Hi, I'm Rafay. I'm in year 10 and I would want to be a dolphin so I could swim fast." And he nominates Corey.
Oh, thank you. Some really good suggestions for animals. And so I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Corey. I'm the Youth Engagement and Digital Executive at RF. I'm 28 years old. And the animal that I was going to pick literally got picked by someone else. I can't believe it. I was going to pick a parrot as well, just like Favour, because I want to fly. I want to be colourful and cheeky and mimic people. So I'm going to switch to your first answer, Favour. I'm picking an eagle for me, because you switched your one. I'm switching mine. And I'm going to nominate Natalie next.
Oh, thanks, everyone. Hi, I'm Natalie. I'm Director of Fundraising and Impact at RF. And if I was going to be an animal, I would be a flamingo. They've got lovely long legs. They're pink and they live in nice warm climates, which I think I could do with at the moment. And I am going to nominate, who have we got left? Oh, is it just Fasana? We've got?
Yeah, so it's just Fasana, Yauchin and Courtney left.
Okay, over to you then.
The animal I'd like to be is a cat, because who doesn't love cats?
Thank you, Fasana. Let me nominate Courtney to go next.
Yeah, my name is Courtney. I'm 18. I'm in my third year of college, I believe. And if I could be an animal, I think I'll be a shark, I guess.
Good choice. Yauchin, I think, is our last person before Tessa.
Hi, I'm Yauchin. I'm in my last year of college. And if I was an animal, I'd be a lion. Because in my neighbour's words, he said, "I'm bolo, fierce and strong."
I love that. Thank you so much. So now I'm going to hand it over to Tessa, who's going to talk about her career and her passion for jewellery making. And yeah, just really excited. Thank you so much, Tessa.
Not at all. Well, first and foremost, like, thank you guys for having me. I'm super honoured. It's a real privilege to talk to all of you today. So thanks for inviting me. As you said, I'm going to kind of like whisk through the sort of journey, I guess, that I've had so far in terms of figuring out why I wanted to be a jewellery designer, why I am a jewellery designer, and then like try and leave like plenty of room at the end for questions, because I think it's one thing for me to talk about what I think might interest you, but I think it's much more important for you guys to have the chance to ask questions about the things that interest you at the end of the day. So I think we're going to start at school, because that's where most, ideas for kind of a career get kind of planted into your head, either by, you know, your peers or teachers, or by the kind of like lessons that you end up enjoying. And for me, the thing that I looked forward to every single day was going to the art room. I loved the art room. It was full of glitter, coloured paper, pens, and it was a space that I kind of really found that I could express myself. A lot of other subjects were quite formulaic. There wasn't much kind of like room for creativity in maths, and, you know, English, the texts were always set, and, you know, games, I wasn't a fan of standing outside in the rain. But in the art room, I really found my space. And I think that kind of nurtured a kind of a love for design in a way that has proved to be, I guess, instrumental in who I am now. And I think the other thing that I really loved about art was that it was super subjective. So there was no right or wrong. It was about, you know, your ideas, developing a story, a storyboard. But you could never be 100% right, and you could never be 100% wrong. And I think in that sense, it was a very liberating subject. And certainly one where you could kind of like pick where you wanted to go, kind of really create things that you felt were kind of representative of yourself. This is sort of, you know, kind of embarrassing when I think about it now. I left school 22 years ago. Which makes me sound super old, although I don't feel that old inside. And when I was at secondary school, the careers department, I wouldn't say, was kind of really up to speed as they probably are now, I think. And when I said to the careers sort of officer, you know, I really love art, I really love design, you know, kind of what's out there for me, I got met with, not that many options. You know, design and sort of creativity, I think, was quite kind of like undervalued as a sort of career option 22 years ago. And the best that they could come up with was, well, why don't you go into the commercial art world and work for one of the kind of big auction houses like Christie's or Sotheby's, and that should satisfy your kind of creative juices. So I went and I worked in the commercial art world, buying and selling pictures on behalf of other people for about 4 years, which, you know, was interesting, but there was very little creativity that I was actually doing. And after 4 years, I decided that it wasn't the right career for me. And actually what I'd really rather do is make things instead of selling other people's beautiful things that they had made. So I took a leap of faith, and with absolutely no kind of prior experience in jewelry design whatsoever, apart from, you know, loving art and loving design, I decided that I was going to set up my kind of dream business, and off I went. And I would say that kind of with hindsight, there is nothing like doing a job that you truly love and that you aren't institutionalized by. So because I didn't have any formal training, because I didn't really know how a jewelry business should necessarily be run, it was extremely liberating. I had complete freedom to kind of build a brand in the way that I wanted to build it, without having, you know, kind of worked for someone else where they would have said, no, you can't do this, or your designs have to look like that, or you have to take it to market in a certain way. This was like kind of my world, my universe to build as I wanted. And that was, I think, really kind of beneficial in so many ways, that I didn't copy what other people did. I didn't feel pressurized to build a business in a way that other people did. But of course, I made a lot of mistakes, because when you're doing something for the first time without any previous experience, you do make a lot of mistakes. But it is in the mistakes that I think you kind of really learn about yourself. I think you really learn about your own brand. So I would say that, you know, you don't have to follow a set path for a job in the kind of creative or design world. You can, as long as you're willing to kind of put the work in and do the research in terms of, you know, how you set up a business or how you make jewelry, then I think that, you know, the world of design and jewelry by extension is a really, really exciting space to be in, because it's kind of anyone's to win. And I think that, you know, I'm sure many of you kind of follow different accounts on Instagram and other kind of social media platforms. And you've all seen how like a brand comes out of nowhere and then becomes like completely global, or, you know, gets kind of celebrity endorsement or whatever it might be. And in the space of kind of creative, in the creative world and in design, like there is the opportunity to do that. So I would say, you know, kind of, it's all about how much like work you want to put in. But why jewelry? And I think that that is a question that I get asked like a lot by editors and journalists. And I think it's a super valid one, because at the end of the day, you need to know the why you want to do something before you go into it. Whether it's you want to become a doctor, why do you want to become a doctor? I want to work in IT. Why do you want to work in IT? Because at the end of the day, I think businesses that have authenticity tend to attract people. They tend to be more successful because, you know, consumers look at them and they feel that there's something really real about them, that the message that they're trying to convey is real, the products that they're trying to sell, you know, have real soul behind them, real heart behind them. So I think the question of why you want to do something is probably, you know, the most important actually when you're kind of thinking about what career you want to go into, or any other actually decision in your life. And for me, there was something about jewelry that sort of separated it from other sectors in the kind of luxury world, and also in the design world and the art world. And that it's timeless. You know, I had a real frustration with fashion, and even more so now, fast forward like 9 years. But it just seems to be a sector that moves faster and faster and faster. And, you know, brands cannot keep up with the kind of requirements that they need to in order to stay relevant, whether it's on social media or online websites. Whereas jewelry is one of those worlds where you can release a collection when you want. If you don't release a collection for a year, you haven't somehow been ostracized, or you don't get sort of pushed out of the party. You create things that, you know, should be relevant for generations to come. You know, jewelry is seen as something that, you know, you should hold on to, that can be passed down, whereas fashion doesn't have that same kind of longevity attached to it. And I didn't want to put all my heart and soul into making things that would then become sort of irrelevant in 10 years time or 10 months time, or, you know, now with social media, sometimes it's even kind of 10 days time. You know, I just didn't want to be part of the rat race of the kind of wider fashion world. I really like the jewelry because for me as an artist, or that's how I kind of, you know, started, or what I loved best at school, it felt like it was sculpture and miniature. And I understood the language of sculpture. I understood the kind of idea of making something in 3D, designing it first in 2D because I could draw, and then converting it into 3D like I did at school with sculpture and ceramics, etc. It felt like it was a kind of an avenue that I had sort of confidence in and I had some experience in. So I knew it was going to be something that, you know, sung to my soul and that naturally kind of already worked for me. I also saw jewelry as a sector that kind of needed like a bit of a kick up the arse, especially the fine jewelry sector. Like it was all, when I first started doing it about 9 years ago, it was all still quite traditional. There wasn't really that new sort of tag of demi-fine jewelry. It was, you know, largely a lot of people playing with diamonds and emeralds and rubies and gold. And, you know, it was much more about carat weight. So how big is the stone as opposed to how good is the design? And I just felt that like it was an area or a sector that I could go into and I could do something different. I could, you know, kind of open a few doors or like, you know, throw a few rainbows out there and sort of, you know, leave my own kind of fingerprint. And there was a chance that I could do that without being kind of saturated or sort of lost in amongst, you know, a million other people doing the same thing. So I did, you know, obviously do a bit of research to see whether there were lots of jewelers out there who were kind of doing what I wanted to do, and I couldn't find anyone. So I sort of thought, okay, well maybe there's a chance here. Because I was, you know, I was very acutely aware that like there is a lot of jewelry out there, and that what you don't want to do is be the person with the megaphone, like screaming into the storm, but you know, no one can hear you. And then, you know, I guess the final reason why I like jewelry, and I think that this has now kind of come out in my jewelry many years on, is it just felt like a discipline with endless opportunity. You know, for me, jewelry doesn't just have to be about gemstones and precious metals. You know, my most recent collection that I'm launching in May fuses together plastic, which is probably one of the cheapest things that you could, you know, find on this planet. And also at the moment, obviously one of the most contentious. So it's about reusing old plastic with gemstones, which is again, something that, you know, you just don't find in the fine jewelry sector. So I was really excited by the kind of opportunity about pairing unusual things together that hadn't been done before. So I thought there was like quite a lot of scope for me to kind of dive in. And so I did. And I think, you know, I've talked about kind of like how the why is so important. And I think, you know, paired with that, I would say creative authenticity is like extremely important when you're kind of trying to carve out a brand, you know, especially in jewelry, because it is quite a saturated marketplace, especially now. But, you know, in any sort of sector. So I kind of, I took a lot of time to think about like, what do I really want to create? What am I really, really about? What three words would I use to kind of represent the jewelry that I want to produce? And I kind of wrote them down in like big scrawly letters on a piece of paper. And after like much brainstorming, the three that kind of I feel and still feel like kind of best represents my brand is curiosity cabinets. So I know it's two words, but we're going to pretend it's one. Juxtaposition and whimsical. And I'll kind of go through why I think each of those kind of are really relevant. And maybe, I don't know if there might be a sort of slideshow of images which might kind of help convey that kind of brand DNA. If we take the image that we've got kind of in front of me, okay, or this one, which is perfect. I hope you can kind of see like a degree of the kind of curiosity cabinet, especially in this image with the kind of the sort of montage, the sort of spread of lots of different like pieces of kind of like jewelry in a kind of rainbow wave. So for me, curiosity cabinets is something that I've always been obsessed with. And I spent a lot of my childhood in the Natural History Museum, which, you know, I still think is like the best museum ever in the entire world. And I still go there and just sort of hang out and, you know, sort of look at all the animals and all the specimens. And that museum is like probably the biggest example of a curiosity cabinet that, you know, you could find in the world. But, you know, they started off curiosity cabinets as like quite small things. So gentlemen, sort of like travelers, would go abroad and they would bring back objects that meant something to them, that sort of spoke to them and that told a story about where they had been, and sort of became kind of symbols of their sort of their taste and who they were. And I've always collected objects from even as a small child. You know, they started off with like leaves and twigs and, you know, kind of built up to like Barbie dolls. And then, you know, kind of from there on was like, you know, the favorite seashell from a holiday, you know, a notebook, an old book cover, you know, an emboss something or other. And I'd arrange them on shelves and I'd kind of look at it and I'd be like, oh, that sort of represents me. And that's how I kind of see my jewelry. I see it as like a kind of ever-evolving collection of objects that represent who I am, both as a kind of person through the themes and through the subjects that I tackle as a jewelry designer, but also like a representation of kind of like my brand. And that's what I mean by creative authenticity. I think the two things have to be like super aligned, like who you are and what your brand is. I think they have to both point in the same kind of direction. And when that happens, I think people really get what you're trying to do or what your brand is all about. So I always think back to my three pillars: curiosity cabinets, whimsical, and juxtaposition every time that I'm organizing an event, designing a new collection, just to kind of really make sure that like I haven't like strayed too far away from that and sort of, you know, been influenced by like commercial pressure or being influenced by something that someone else says to me, because, you know, that happens. Of course it does. You know, everyone always has an opinion about everything. So that's curiosity cabinets. Juxtaposition, again, me talking a little bit how like I like playing around with like plastic, gemstones. I like the idea of exploring different materials and putting them together to see how they work. I like the idea of high-low and low-low. I like kind of playing around with unexpected pairings. And that's also quite representative of like how I dress. So I often will like match like trainers jeans with like a much more kind of like sparkly top, or, you know, I'm just as happy playing in the mud at home on our farm as I am kind of going to a slightly more smart work event. Like I'm quite a kind of polar opposite person. I'm actually fundamentally sometimes quite shy. And yet when I go to work or I put on my work face like now, I'm really happy to talk. So I'm like this kind of contradiction myself in a weird way. And so that sort of, I think, kind of permeates through my collection. And then the last one being kind of whimsical. Well, you know, I think sometimes like everyone needs like a huge dose of rainbows and pop culture and sparkly stuff and like pink stuff and naff stuff and, you know, things that kind of don't necessarily sit normally in the luxury sector. But in the same way that kind of Andy Warhol as an artist, you know, took the most kind of sort of low grade objects and to transform them into like the most collectible art, I see a sort of charm in using things like the weather or penny sweets you know, any other form of kind of like object part of pop culture and trying to make it and elevate it into something that's timeless and like, you know, wonderful. Because sometimes like the smallest things in life or the everyday things in life are actually kind of like, you know, as important as the most special things. So like whimsical and that sort of sense of irony and satire also like plays quite strongly in my jewelry, and it plays very strongly in my life. you know, I've just had a baby, and the amount of unicorn shit that I have been given is like unbelievable. Because obviously that's everyone like knows how much I love that kind of like stuff. And you know, her room is just like one like enormous unicorn like universe. So I guess people have like kind of understood what I'm all about. I think that sort of like gives you a kind of fundamental, I suppose, about like how I created the brand, how I go about kind of creating a collection. I think the best way of kind of showing that is if I show you the sketchbook. Don't worry, I'm not going to show you every single page. We'd be here until like, you know, kind of Christmas. But if I show you how it starts life, and again, tell me if I need to sort of put it close to the camera or not, but this is like what I do for about 6 months, and this in itself is a kind of curiosity cabinet. It just happens to be like 2D and on paper, but I start with an idea for a theme, and then I brainstorm it. So this collection is going to be all about 1950s Florida, where these big hotels started putting in like really luxurious, enormous pools, which started this like whole culture of like poolside living that had never really been experienced in America or in the world beforehand. And it's called Plastic Fantastic. So it's also the decade where, you know, Barbie was invented, where, you know, plastic surgery kind of first like had its sort of experimentations. So it's very like poppy, it's very bright. So obviously this page I still have to like fill in. But it kind of just, you know, there's maps, there's inspirational photos, there's like designs that I've kind of like started to sort of, you know, play around with, you know, images of kind of, so these are the gumball earrings, and here I've got like kind of reference sort of images of like similar shapes and colors. Here I've got like a whole page where I explore different gemstone options to go with the gumball earrings. Here I've got like little sketches, little drawings. So it's just basically a sort of a dump, a mental dump of all my ideas. And that's how they kind of basically start off life in this like wonderfully higgledy-piggledy like 2D type version. And from that, I'll then, you know, spend a bit of time like being really honest with myself about what works and what doesn't work. And sometimes that like, you do have to let go of designs that just haven't been so successful. And then from there, we'll probably go from maybe 40 designs down to 20 designs. Obviously, like, you know, I have to get quotes to see how much each one is going to cost and whether it's a budget or not. But when I feel like I'm sort of ready to go to market, then obviously you do your kind of like, you know, your big press emails, and you try and contact everyone and try and get them to listen to you, and they pretend that they're super busy and like they obviously don't have time, and then you have to like pester them another 20 times. But you kind of get used to the sort of routine of being a jewelry designer. And then you do, you know, your photography. And I don't know if we can go to the image where there's the jewelry on the kind of garden scene. Yeah, perfect. So what I then try and do is I try and do like a kind of photo shoot that really brings to life the inspiration behind the collection. So this one, Once Upon a Time in My Secret Garden, was inspired by gardens from literature, famous gardens from literature. I suppose the most famous one being The Secret Garden by Frances Hodgkin Burnett. And I imagined like what animals and flowers would live in my own secret garden. So I kind of wanted the campaign shoot to sort of feel like you'd been shrunk down to like 2 inches, and you'd found yourself like kind of meandering through this like secret garden that no one had ever discovered before. And I don't know if we can go back to the pastely looking one with the building blocks. Yeah, that one. So that was the Mexicana collection, which was inspired by architecture in Mexico, both ancient and modern day. So again, I've used like paper maquettes in the shape of kind of temples and more modernist architecture to try and bring out some of the kind of shapes and forms, building block forms that you see in the jewelry, especially the kind of bracelet with this idea of like brickwork. And then if we go back to the one where the glasses are on the table, yeah, that one. So this collection was inspired by famous cocktails from around the world. So I made these like resin cocktails, these fake cocktails, and if you can see the little Buddha earrings, they're the Singapore sling earrings. Then at the bottom, the sort of yellowy ones, they're the flaming Lamborghini. So I also try and give names to the pieces that like kind of represent what they're meant to be sort of about. And then to the left of those, you've got the most obvious ones, which are the gin and tonic earrings, where you've got the lemon and the cucumber. So that's where the kind of whimsy comes in. And you know, for me, like creating this kind of stuff is just like joy. It's like heaven. It's sort of everything that I did when I was a child, you know, in sort of building little homes for like my Barbie dolls and kind of dressing them in like horrendous outfits and pretending that they were on the catwalk and all the rest of it. Like, I love curating stuff. I love creating stuff. And, you know, hopefully I produce collections that people kind of get what they're all about. So I think I've definitely spoken for long enough. So I'm going to shut up and now allow other people to ask questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Tessa. That was so detailed and it was so interesting to hear your approach as well. I think it's Ose who has her hand up.
Yeah, so I literally just came because I was busy doing something. And let me tell you, I've never related to like someone who came to speak to us in my life. Oh my gosh.
Oh, fine.
You're talking about like the rainbows and everything. Oh, like, oh yes, that's me. And like, well, opposites. Like one day I'll be dressing all black and next day I'll be dressing in pastels. Like, I relate to you so much on that. And I really like designing. I make clothes and stuff. And right now I'm kind of like looking into like Lolita fashion because I kind of like that kind of silhouette of clothes and stuff. And I love like your whole process of how you said, like, you pick like a location, like Secret Garden and thing, like something like that. And then you basically take apart that kind of scene. I just love that so much. I'm just going to start off asking, do you take apprenticeship?
Would I take an apprenticeship?
Yeah, do you?
Well,
yeah.
we haven't like had a formal kind of apprenticeship what would you call it, like program to date, but it's something that I think is super important and that like we would absolutely consider. But you know, even without a program, like I would be delighted to sit down and talk to you further about like what you want to build and how you want to build it and help in any way I can. So, you know, regardless of an apprenticeship program, you know, if you would like to take this conversation offline at some point and when we can meet up again and have like a kind of sort of, you know, a good few hours sort of session, then I'd be totally delighted.
Honestly, that is absolutely amazing. And okay, this is my actual real question now.
Sure.
How do you source your materials? Like, do you source your materials ethically and stuff? Like, how do you go about with that?
Sure.
And how has
okay.
your supply chain been
yeah.
now during the pandemic? Oh, sorry,
do you mind saying the last bit again? Because I didn't hear that so well.
Oh, and has like your supply chain been disrupted because of the pandemic? And how have you like dealt with that?
Okay, got you. So for the ethical side of things, believe it or not, jewelry can be super transparent and it can also be very not transparent. So I make all my jewelry in the UK because I believe in paying my workforce, my staff, whatever you want to call it, a fair wage. But I would say that a lot of other jewellery designers, even some of the biggest names who claim to be British jewellery houses, do not do that. And they absolutely exploit the cheap labour costs in India, in the Middle East, in the Far East. So from a kind of like person perspective, I think that, you know, kind of we've definitely nailed the ethical side of things. From a gemstone perspective, we have like our trusted dealers that, you know, I know where the stones come from. I know what I'm buying. I know that it's the right price and everything's kind of fair. But even with these trusted dealers, when you get to stones that are quite small, and I, like I said in my talk, I don't really deal with like super big stones unless I'm working on a commission for someone who wants a specific stone. I tend to like deal with slightly cheaper stones, slightly smaller stones, partly out of budget and partly because actually I think there's a lot of undervalued material out there that hasn't been like, you know, used by the sector yet. It can be quite hard to trace the origin of those. And although we do our very best to do so, a lot of stuff gets lost in trading and in transport. And I would say that that's probably one area of the sector that isn't so good. And it doesn't matter how good you try and being about it, there are just certain blockages in sort of buying from the source. You know, a lot of mines don't even sell direct to jewelry designers. They will only sell to like the stone cutters, and then the stone cutters will only sell to the stone dealers. And then that's when the trade gets involved. So there are places where it can be quite difficult to be completely transparent. The second point about has our business been disrupted because of the pandemic? Yes. I mean, not many people want to buy jewelry when the world is like, you know, turned upside down. You know, and that is, you know, one of the great risks with the luxury market is that, you know, you can get knocked around by sort of economic and sort of global forces a little bit. I mean, last year from March to July was a bit of a shit show. You know, our business sort of was sort of somewhere at the bottom of the ocean because no one was buying jewelry. I mean, luckily, you know, we've been trading for almost 9 years now. So we had a bit of a kind of a bumper to like keep us going. But, you know, I probably had like one email in my inbox a week, you know, and that's quite depressing. So we sort of, we managed to kind of get on with other things that we needed doing, like, you know, kind of our website and other stuff like that. But yeah, it was a bit worrying. And you know, thankfully now, touch wood, you know, things have kind of picked up back to normal. So, you know, just keep our fingers crossed.
Honestly, it's glad to hear that. And like with like ethically sourcing jewels, I remember I was watching this documentary on like mica and stuff,
yeah,
in like makeup products, and how that's so hard to like source and everything. So at least we're being honest about it. Yeah, but thank you so much.
Not at all, thank you.
Thank you. So the next question that I can see in the chat is from Georgie. Do you want to come on the mic and ask Tessa yourself?
Yeah,
go ahead.
What was the first line of jewellery that you produced?
So actually it was Mexicana, which is that image with the little house. So don't ask me why Mexicana or Mexico. I've never been. And actually that's kind of something that is quite interesting. I tend to pick themes for my collections that I don't necessarily have firsthand experience of. So I kind of like them to be quite imaginary, because in that way I'm not restrained by what I know or learned experience. So for example, the image above, the one with the boat in the bottle, I don't know if you can see, yeah, that one. I hate boats. I hate boats with a passion. I hate being on the sea. I get terrible seasickness, but I love this idea of there being a kind of age of discovery in history where people got into boats to go and explore uncharted waters and undiscovered islands. And, you know, this whole kind of like sort of race to kind of like, you know, sort of find new lands and animals and all the rest of it. Like, I found that really, really exciting. So I often do kind of like do collections that I have no intention of ever living myself. But to go back to your question, yeah, Mexicana was the first collection that I did.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
And the next question is from Fazana. Fazana asks, how long does it take to design one piece of jewellery from start to finish?
So for a if we're talking about like a collection piece, then that's a bit hard because I design the collection in its entirety at the same time, because I feel that for a successful collection, you've got to design all the pieces in tandem, so that they all speak the same language, so that you don't have too many earrings and not enough rings. So I suppose for a collection, you know, that can take almost kind of like, I don't know, 6 months from like your first idea through to having, you know, the last sort of piece signed off on paper, because I really believe in the importance of narrative integrity and storytelling. So I really do a lot of research. I do a lot of thinking, and I make sure that there's like real soul and heart behind the pieces before I then kind of commission them to be made. For a bespoke piece, so that's like, you know, one item on its own generally, that can be anything from one day. If like, I totally nail the client's brief, like we're speaking the same language, you know, there aren't too many kind of constraints on budget, I can be a bit free in my sort of designing, then I can do it as quickly as like a day, sometimes even quicker, half a day, depending on the complexity, obviously, of the piece. And then sometimes, oh my God, some bespoke projects, you know, I've had one that's gone on almost a year because the client couldn't make up their mind and they kept wanting to go back to the original thing. Then they changed their, like, their mind on the budget, then the stone, then the this, the that. And, you know, by the time you get to like the piece actually being made, like, I'm a grandmother. So like, it just really, really depends. Really depends.
Thank you. And the next question is from Favour. Favour, do you want to come on the mic and ask?
Yeah. When you were speaking about ethics earlier and you said that you get it done in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and then you mentioned about other big companies that identify as British companies, but they still exploit other places where they can get it for cheap labor. I was saying that that I like how your approach to that ethical issue is, but wouldn't that make you charge more for the jewelry?
So, Favour, that is like an extremely astute and correct point. So one of the reasons, obviously, that these jewelry houses manufacture abroad is because it's much cheaper. And what is kind of ironic for them is that they still charge the prices as if the jewelry was made in the UK. So they're just marking up their jewelry sometimes 500%, 400%, and just making a lot of money. What I do is I do make it in the UK. It does cost me more money, but I'm very transparent about what my markup is, both for my stock pieces and also for my bespoke pieces. And I try and keep it as fair and obviously as low as possible, because I'm still starting out, you know, really in my career. I mean, I know I've been doing this almost for like 9 years, but I'm not an international name. You know, I haven't conquered the UK market. So I don't really... I would be risking quite a lot if I was to charge 400% markup on my pieces. Like, I would just outprice myself and no one would come and buy my stuff at all. I keep it as low as I can. But yes, if we're going to compare like to like, making a gold wedding band, if I had to make one for a client, making it in the Far East and then bringing it over and selling it to them would be much cheaper for me. And you would buy my jewelry at a cheaper price. But I don't think that sometimes cheaper means better. And certainly when it comes to labor and, you know, kind of ethics behind that, I feel that what I pay my goldsmiths, my stone cutters, et cetera, is, you know, like, it's a super, super fair, if not kind of premium price. They earn more by hour than like most people do. So you have to make decisions, don't you, about like, you know, how you want to run your business and how much you have to charge for your product. And I've made ones that I think feel right for me.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Yalcin, would you like to come on the mic and ask your question?
Where do you get your inspiration from for the designs of your work?
So in about a million different places, and how the inspiration comes can be super random. It could be a conversation with someone. It could be a magazine article that I read. So I did a collection about opium dens, and I imagined the jewelry that the courtesans in opium dens in like 18th century China would wear. And that was based on a magazine article that I read about this journalist who went to Southeast Asia to try and find, you know, the 21st century opium den. So, you know, there are things that I read that then, you know, kind of think you transport, you know, kind of, to a different world or a different universe. And then I think to myself, God, I really like, you know, kind of that idea, and I want to sort of harness it and capture it. I mean, there are lots of themes that come into my head that get parked there for many years. I haven't quite found the right angle to it. I'm not convinced if I think it would make a good jewelry collection, but there's still something about the idea that I like. So it's kind of... It's anywhere and everywhere, and some of them make the grade and a lot of them just don't. I mean, a couple of collections I do start, and then after about 2 weeks, you know, I just put the scrapbook down and I put it back on the shelf, or I burn it. Like, if I get really frustrated with something, I burn it. It's almost like it can never exist ever again. And, you know, often like my mother's like sort of like looking at me like chucking stuff onto the fire, and she's like, you're mad. But, you know, maybe that's like a kind of, you know, kind of the madness of someone who's creative. Like, if I don't like something, I just kind of can't be in the same space with it. If I've made like kind of mistake on a design and it's completely irreparable, it's like, I just rather put it in the bin. But going back to your point, you know, the world is such a kind of, it's such a kind of fantastical and magical thing sometimes, not always, but sometimes. But you just don't need to go very far to find the fantastical or the magical. And, you know, I would say like books is like probably one of the most accessible ways of finding a theme. You know, there's public libraries, there's like endless topics and themes. And, you know, I spend a lot of time there, just even like going up and down the aisles, looking for book covers that I like the look of, because that's often like how I first get kind of inspired. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
And so we've got two questions from Chuck. Unfortunately, Chuck's had to leave, so I'm going to ask them from him. His first question is, how did you feel when you had your first sale? And what advice can you give to someone starting a business?
Okay, how did I feel with my first sale? I don't know if I can swear here, but I'm going to anyway. Being relieved would be the honest answer. You know, I'd like created this collection. I'd invited all these people to like the launch party. You know, there was some press there. There were people that I knew that bought jewelry there. You know, I had like my little display up. And like when I heard the first like, you know, ring of the till symbolically, I just felt relieved. And, you know, that sensation for me has never disappeared. You know, I never take a sale for granted, like not in a million years. Even a sale for like the most cheap thing that we have on our website is still joyous. And I think that actually kind of leads quite well to the second question, because the biggest piece, or one of the biggest pieces of advice I'd give to anyone starting their own business or just in business, is you never know who is buying from you. And the person that might spend £30 one day could be spending £30,000 with you in 2 years' time, because people do make money really quickly, especially in the tech world these days. But, you know, anyone can have a super lucky turn of affair, and it could take 5 years, it could take 10 years, it could take 20 years. But if you treat everyone exactly the same, regardless of how much they're spending, and you give everyone the same airtime, you give everyone the same consideration, and you answer everyone's questions, and you treat them with the same enthusiasm and love, then I think that people do remember you. Like later on in life, I think they really do. And I've had it with, you know, a couple of clients that started off buying, you know, £40, £50, then they moved to £200, £300, £400, then maybe £1,000. And then when it came to like wanting to buy, you know, their wife a present to commemorate their first child or an engagement ring or whatever it might be, they've come back and then they've spent quite a lot of money. And, you know, that's a real honor, you know, making a piece of jewelry for someone for their engagement ring or, you know, to commemorate a birth of a child. And I think that's, you know, one of the best ways of kind of also, you know, creating loyalty in a brand. So like never undervalue who it is who's standing in front of you.
It's really good advice and a really good two questions from Chuck as well. So I think the final question is from Sat. Sat, I know you have a question.
Yeah, nice, brilliant. But Tessa, it's been really nice to hear all the different places you get the inspiration from the history stuff to the places and seeing the photos. I'd love to ask about how you come up with the photos and arrange them with the, like the ship in the bottle. Like it all, it's quite nice, quite creative. And I think just hearing that is quite refreshing for us, because we have a lot of careers that people, it's quite sort of traditional. It's just really nice to hear about having creativity with your career. And wanted to ask you about, there's a few of our group on the call today who, like myself, I had dyslexia, so I struggled at school. And like you said, the art room and art for me was the only GCSE I actually got. So it's like a window to the world. And I was just wondering, sort of, do you have any advice for our young people on the call and for the young people who will be listening about if they have the same experience when you go to careers people, and even it could be parents, it could be relatives or people, you know, uncles who know best, whatever. And it's like, you should get a proper job and, you know, like, how's a creative career going to go? Do you have any advice for us on that, please?
Yeah, I mean, like, I would say, again, I don't want to be controversial, but here we go. You really have to not listen to most people in life when it comes to the decisions you make about your career. And, you know, university is not the be end and all at all in any way, shape or form. You know, it is if you want to spend 4 years or 3 years really like delving into a subject, or you want to become a doctor or an architect or whatever it might be. Like there are some, you know, kind of, there are some applications where it's super important, or, you know, everyone has the right to go and like further learn about something. But apprenticeships can be like even more rewarding. And I would say that for anyone who struggles with dyslexia, with writing, with spelling, all the rest of it, if you have two eyes and you have a mouth and you can talk and you can look, that's actually really all you need to get into the creative industry. You know, yes, it helps if you can, you know, if you're able to get access to a computer, or, you know, to get and spend, you know, a day like asking someone questions, or, you know, in the same way that I volunteer to happily kind of like speak to anyone who wants to further discuss like delving into any kind of creative career. Like, again, this goes to anyone. I'm more than happy to take it offline and go further. But, you know, most people have a mobile phone and most people have Instagram on that phone. And that is really kind of enough what you need to understand what's out there and what the possibilities are in terms of careers. You know, whether you search like window dressing or stylist or, you know, kind of graphic designer or sign painter or artist or whatever it might be, there are so many avenues now, so many different jobs that you can do in a kind of creative sense that I wasn't even aware of when I left school. When I was in school, even like, you know, at university, which is a complete waste of time for me, that I think that, you know, you don't need a kind of formal diploma or certificate to get into them and to dive into them. You know, most of the people that I know who have been successful in creative industries have walked and talked their way into the jobs, begged, you know, done anything they could in Condé Nast offices, in magazine offices, in stylist offices, in artist offices, artist workshops, foundries, I mean, glass blowing studios. Like, people are really generous in the creative industry about taking people on, because that's often how they started in the first place. So I think that all it takes is for you to, you know, put on, you know, kind of like, you know, clean clothes and go knocking. And that's how most people kind of get their jobs, you know. And if you offer to kind of start at the bottom and work your way up, and you're attentive and you're on time and you listen and you're passionate and enthusiastic, that really translates and goes a really long, long way. Yes, you have to do a little bit of research about what avenue you think you might like to go down. But, you know, there is the internet and there is social media, and hopefully those are enough resources to get like a bit of a grounding. But quite frankly, like, you know, if you come across anyone in a careers department who says otherwise, like, I would tell them to f*** off, because it's just not true. You know, like, it's just that, but often people who are in careers department actually have very little life experience of getting jobs outside, like signing up for a careers department job. Do you mean that's the kind of like weird irony about them? So, you know, if you want it, anything in life is possible.
Awesome. Thank you. I think that's exact advice we want to give. That's really, really appreciated. And thanks for making time for today as well. Like, it's really, really appreciated.
Oh my God, it's just, it's such a pleasure. And I think that, you know, what you guys are doing is brilliant. And, you know, I haven't met all of you guys on the phone call, but, you know, I have no doubt that you're all amazing and special in your own ways. And, you know, I wish you all like so much luck and happiness and fulfillment in whatever it is that you decide that you want to do in life. You know, my father, who sadly is no longer with us, but he always used to say to my sister and I, it doesn't matter what on earth it is that you want to do in life. You can be, you know, a street sweeper, you can be an architect, you can work in philanthropy, you can look after the animals in London Zoo, you can do whatever you want, as long as you try and do it to the best of your ability. And I think that that is probably the only thing that really matters. Like, go out there, find what you're passionate about, and then try and do the best you can do.
I think that's such a good note to end on. Can we all come off the mic and give Tessa a round of applause, please, for that amazing talk?
Oh no.
Thank you.
I'm late, but thank you.
Oh.
Just want to say thanks so much, Tessa. That was really good advice. I learned so much. I was writing it down, so really appreciate it.
Oh, that's so sweet. And like I said, look, if anyone does genuinely like want to talk about you know, going into the creative industries, or things that, like, you know, I might be able to sort of shed some light or be helpful in any way, you guys have my email. So, you know, feel free to do the intros and, you know, I'll kind of, you know, hear if you need me.
Thank you so much.
Okay, it's a great pleasure. Have a lovely evening, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Take care. You can't see that I'm waving, but I'm waving.
Thank you so much, Tessa, for talking to us. We were so inspired by that talk. We had loads of fun as well. It was amazing seeing your scrapbook and then your past collections and you talking through that creative process. We really appreciate that. You gave us some really good advice about getting into the industry and knocking on doors, and it just felt us, it left us feeling really valued and positive and looking forward to the future. So we really appreciate this, Tessa. Thank you. Thanks to everyone who listened to this episode. Get in touch, let us know what your favorite part of it was or who you'd like to see on our podcast. And most importantly, if you like this episode, share it so other people can hear it. Subscribe to us so you can see when the latest ones come out. And also go to our website, renaissance-foundation.com, where you can find out more information about who we are, who we support, and also how you can donate to make a massive impact to the young people.